This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting KUER Public Radio in Salt Lake City. There's a lot of news coming out of Washington this week, like every week, but this week, we're doing something different. Since we're in Utah, we're reviewing some of the week's top domestic news with a focus on how it impacts the Mountain West, including Utah, Colorado, Montana, Idaho, and Wyoming. For instance, farmers in Utah and Idaho are concerned about new tariffs. Trade is now a key political issue in the Utah Senate race. A historic number of Native American women are running for office, including for Congress and for governorships. Montana has more than a dozen Native Americans running for the state house just this year. We'll also discuss stories from the Mountain West that the rest of the nation tends to ignore, like a recent march and prayer vigil on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana. It was to raise awareness about the disappearance of a young woman named Ashley Loring Heavy Runner. Activists say that Native American women are sexually assaulted and murdered at alarming rates. Also, the FCC's repeal of the net neutrality rules could have big effects in rural mountain communities, and we'll look ahead to wildfire season after 8 homes burned in Moab, Utah this week. Joining us here at KUER in Salt Lake City is its managing editor, Julia Ritchie. Julia, welcome to 1A.
Pleasure to be here.
Joining us from Montana Public Radio in Missoula is Nate Hedgie, a reporter for Mountain West News Bureau. Nate, welcome.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Joining us from Albuquerque, New Mexico is Antonia Gonzalez, an anchor and producer for the National Native News and a member of the Navajo Nation. Antonia, glad to have you with us.
Glad to be here.
And joining us from KRCC Public Radio in Colorado Springs is Allie Budner, Southern Colorado reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. Allie, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me.
Let's start with trade. And Julia Ritchie, let me start with you here at KUER. The trade battles between the Trump administration and Canada, China, and Europe were big news this week. The president launched a war of words and tariffs on Canada. Just this morning, we learned that the administration is going to set new tariffs on Chinese goods through the U.S. Trade Representative Lighthizer. And these trade conflicts are concerning a lot of farmers in Utah and also in Idaho. Let's start with Utah. What are some of the big concerns here?
I think Mountain West states and Mountain West producers are feeling caught in the crossfire here. Utah alone exports something like $40 million in beef and pork to China. And the World Trade Center of Utah has come out and said, you know, this could really put a big dent in that. So farmers are kind of feeling like, what's going on? You know, a lot of them were supportive of the Trump administration, and they're not quite sure how these are going to play out. So it's becoming an issue here, and I think the consensus from the business and the political community is like, we have our economy is doing fine, it's growing. Let's not ruin that momentum.
Utah really is, just from driving around here, it's easy, and from talking to people, this place is booming. Like, people want to come here.
Yeah, and there's a lot of big building projects going on. You might have noticed the Salt Lake International Airport is expanding. They're building a new state prison. And budget managers on those construction sites are wondering, you know, how much is this steel going to cost me now to procure? So there are real implications here for steel and iron manufacturers, because we export that too. And I think the real concern, especially from political leaders and the World Trade Center, is we're going to damage relationships with our best trading allies, including Canada, Mexico, and the EU.
Yeah, that airport, I think, is slated to be done, the expansion, in 2020, and it's still kind of in the scaffolding stage.
Right, you can see the bones of it.
Exactly. Pig farmers in Idaho are also concerned about this. Tell us more about that.
I think that it's the same here. Again, we sell a lot of pork to China, Hong Kong, Japan as well. And I think the tariffs are... They're just a concern because they're not really sure how the retaliatory effects of that, right? And so those costs will go up for consumers as well as the producers.
Now, trade has been a hot button issue in our economy for sure, but this is an election year, and it's become a hot button in the Utah Senate race. Mitt Romney is one of the candidates. He was asked about tariffs during a debate last month. Here's part of what he had to say.
Trade wars aren't good for us and not good for anybody. And no one in the world, I think, wants to see a trade war. And hopefully we'll be able to avoid that. But you can't walk away from the table just because you're fearful about what might happen. You got to stand up for American interests. And as a senator from Utah, I got to stand up for Utah's interests.
That was Mitt Romney speaking during a debate last month. Julia, talk about how trade is coming up politically here.
Right. So the Republican Mitt Romney is running against a conservative state lawmaker named Mike Kennedy. Mike Kennedy has tried to position himself a little closer to Trump on this, is supportive of the America First policy. We've seen this in some other congressional races around the country as well. Mitt Romney has kind of done the balls and strikes approach to Trump administration policy, where he's generally supportive of them. But again, I don't think these are targeted enough, these tariffs, to really be effective, is what he's saying. So I don't think he's supportive of a broad-based trade war. I mean, Utah would be hurt in that, and it's already been discussed.
Do we have a sense of how that's playing out with voters? I mean, which way do Utahns seem to be leaning right now?
Well, it's weird. Utah's sort of this, I don't know, describe it as Trump agnostic state, where, I mean, his support has been around 50%. So I don't think Mitt Romney is going to be hurt if he wants to distinguish himself a little bit away from Trump on this. Again, our economy is doing really well, and I think most Utah voters want to see that momentum continue.
Let's shift to Nate Hedgie joining us from Montana. Nate, ranchers in Montana, as I understand it, have been working on a deal to export $200 million of beef to China. There was a Chinese delegation that visited Montana last fall. I'm sure that the talk of the tariffs now has thrown all of that into at least uncertainty, if not chaos. What's going on there?
Yes, there's uncertainty. Now, we are shipping beef to China right now. And so ranchers are happy about that. And if you talk to our Montana Republican Senator Steve Daines, this whole beef deal was kind of his baby. He's not one to go against Trump. And so he says he's feeling optimistic that things will continue moving forward. But I think you were right on the dot when you said there's a lot of uncertainty right now.
Are the ranchers and the Chinese delegation, what's the conversation between them like right now? Is everyone just in kind of wait and see mode, or do people feel these deals could be salvaged?
According to an Associated Press article recently, the company that they signed this $200 million deal with has gone kind of radio silent since there's been all this talk of tariffs. There's also supposed to be a processing plant built here in Montana. That was another $100 million additionally to the $200 million deal to sell beef. And so, again, uncertainty, a lot of, no talking happening right now.
And I just want to be clear, Nate, this $200 million deal, this would be a deal to grow beef exports to China. This isn't to maintain existing business, right? This would be new business.
No, this is to grow it. So last May, China agreed to lift a ban on U.S. beef. And that's when Senator Steve Daines invited the Chinese delegation out to Montana, dressed up the Chinese ambassador like a cowboy. They rode around on horses. And then they struck this massive deal to export beef, which ranchers were super, super excited about.
We're speaking to Nate Hedgie, Montana reporter from Mountain West News Bureau. Also, Julia Ritchie, managing editor here at KUER in Salt Lake City, as well as Antonia Gonzalez, anchor and producer for National Native News, and Ali Budner, Southern Colorado reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. We'd love to hear from you wherever you are in the country. Your questions or thoughts on the week's top stories, and especially if you are listening to us from any of the states that are served by the Mountain West News Bureau, we'd love to know what's on your mind. What stories do you wish the country was paying more attention to that affect you where you are, but also affect the rest of the nation as well? Antonia Gonzalez, let me shift gears to you. We were talking about the midterm elections. There's a lot to discuss with the midterms as it relates to Native American women who are running for political office, including Congress and governor's offices. I wonder if we could talk about a few of them, including Paulette Jordan, who's running for governor of Idaho. Tell us about Paulette Jordan.
Yeah, so Paulette Jordan was recently here campaigning for another candidate, Deb Haaland, who's running for Congress. And, you hear the Native women saying maybe it's the year for Native women, as you had mentioned earlier, that there are many Native candidates, Native women candidates running for office. And I think a lot of Native people can relate. They can relate definitely to the issues facing Indian country. And so I think there's a lot of supporters out there who are relating to these women and the issues that they're bringing forward, including healthcare, education, housing, economic development, and other issues that these women are bringing forward that a lot of Native Americans across the country are dealing with. And so I think that you'll see a lot of excitement. We see a lot of excitement on social media for the candidates, especially when they're after their recent wins in their primary elections.
Technical question for you, Antonia. Susan emailed, if a Native American lives on a reservation, which is considered a sovereign nation, can they run for office to represent a district they don't live in? I presume the answer is yes, isn't it, Antonia? Especially if they're running for statewide office. But what do you think?
As far as I know, I'm not 100% sure, but it sounds like you can run for office.
Yeah, I would presume so. I know we have to pause in a moment, and I do want to talk to you more about this, Antonia, but what do we think of Paulette Jordan's chances? She is a progressive politician in a red state, Idaho.
Well, we can't discount the Native vote. Yes, historically, Native people often have been not huge supporters to go out in the polls. There's a lot of reasons for that, including a lot of issues when it comes to voting. I mean, some people have to drive hours to get to a poll, so there's that, and including maybe some language barriers and also just mistrust. But that doesn't mean that Native voters can swing elections.
Right.
We look back at Alaska and look at U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski, where the Native vote there is credited for her winning her write-in campaign. So I think if Native voters turn out to the polls, we can definitely see some action at the polls.
Julia Ritchie, some of the tribes in Utah have been pushing the state's governor to make a seat for them in his cabinet. Talk a little more about that.
So the Utah Tribal Leaders Association a couple months ago during the legislative session here had held a press conference and asked the governor to elevate the director of the Division of Indian Affairs to a cabinet level position. This is something that is kind of a spillover from the Bears Ears fight, which you guys talked about on your show yesterday.
Right.
And a lot of Native groups feeling like they were shut out of that decision making process, both with the governor's office and the Interior Department. Other states have this as a cabinet level position in the state, including New Mexico and Arizona. And right now, that department sits under like the Department of Heritage and Culture, which they say, you know, relegates Native issues to an artifact. It hasn't really gone anywhere, but it is something that the governor's office says, you know, we'll look at.
And what would this actually give the tribes the power to do? Is it just about having the ear of the governor more regularly?
It's about having a better seat at the table. Right now, there's like a liaison committee for Indian Affairs, and that only meets when they want to meet. If they created a standing committee in the legislature, that they would have regular input on policies, and they would meet more often.
Antonia Gonzalez, let me back up to something we discussed earlier in terms of the chances for candidates like Paulette Jordan to win. Getting out the vote, as you kind of alluded to, has been an issue for some rural Native Americans, partly because polling places may be hours away from where they live. There are language barriers. What are you seeing that's being done to help close that gap in November?
So there are a lot of tribes, tribal leaders, and Native organizations, including the National Congress of American Indians, that work year-round to get out the Native vote, to educate people about voting, and to talk about why it's important to be counted and to go out and vote. So there are a lot of efforts. There are even grassroots groups across the country who work on this year-round, like I said, to try to get people to get to the polls. And there's also the Native American Rights Fund that is holding hearings across the country, looking at these issues when it comes to voting, holding meetings in communities saying what is going on with voting and making sure that Native people are being able to have a right to vote in their communities. So I think there's a lot going on. And like I said, year round, there's a lot of talk by tribal leaders, grassroots groups, and community members who really see the importance about getting out the Native vote.
Nate Hedgey, Montana has more than a dozen Native Americans running for the state house this year. Can you tell us a little bit about some of them?
Well, yeah, we've got seven reservations, pretty sizable Native population here in Montana. And so most of the candidates are Democrat. There's one Republican up in the Blackfeet Reservation. And then, as Antonia was talking about, there's a lot of grassroots organization happening here in the state to push out the vote here in Indian Country. And one of the big things, I think, I know it happened last session, and I'm curious to see what will happen, whether it will happen in our next session, is pushing money towards suicide prevention efforts on reservations here. Montana has one of the highest, I think we actually have the highest suicide rate in the country, and American Indians and Alaska Natives also have very high suicide rates. And so there's been a push to get federal and state money to the reservations to help with suicide prevention efforts.
Nate, let me stick with you as we shift gears to another story that has affected Native American tribes for some time and I think is just beginning to get more attention. A march and prayer vigil took place last week on the Blackfeet Reservation in Montana. It came 1 year after a young woman named Ashley Loring Heavyrunner went missing. Nate Hedgie, Montana reporter for Mountain West News Bureau at Yellowstone Public Radio, was at the march last weekend. You've been reporting from the Blackfeet Reservation about the disappearance of Ashley Loring Heavyrunner. You spoke to Ashley's mother, Loxie Loring, as part of your reporting for Mountain West News Bureau. Here is a bit of what she told you.
She's not gone because she wants to be gone, you know. And I do now, after the days go by, and now that it's a year, I know something happened to her.
That's Loxie Loring, the mother of Ashley Loring Heavyrunner. Nate, tell us about this case. What happened?
So about a year ago, Ashley Loring disappeared from the Blackfeet Reservation right around, I believe, June 9th. And it's been a year now since she went missing. The FBI got involved a few months ago. And so you've had tribal cops, BIA, Glacier County Sheriff's Department all looking for this woman. And there's been hundreds of leads and a huge lack of resources up there in north central Montana. When I say lack of resources, I mean, you know, you've got, I think there's one deputy from Glacier County that's on the case. He's also the drug guy. He's also the coroner. He's also the forensic investigator. He wears many, many hats. And so it just takes a really, really, really long time to find people in rural places like this. And so there's a lot of frustration, especially from the family. I mean, Loxie is happy that the FBI is on the case. She thinks it took too long. But there's a lot of reasons as to why the FBI would or wouldn't get involved in a case like this. Mainly their responsibility is towards things like murder or rape, and we don't know necessarily what happened to Ashley. And so there's a lot of frustration around there. And that was just one of those interviews, you know, talking with her where you just want to not be a reporter anymore and just give a person a hug, because it's just really, really hard, not just on her, on the family, but the entire Browning community up there.
Antonio Gonzalez, I imagine that this is not an isolated case. I mean, I think perhaps this is unique because it's been transferred from BIA, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, to the FBI. But activists have been saying for some time, Antonio, that Native American women are being sexually assaulted and murdered at rates that are high enough that it should provoke more attention.
So there are a lot of issues when it comes to missing and murdered Indigenous women, including there's no official database of these cases, so it's unclear how many of these cases there really are. There's also jurisdiction issues, tribal criminal justice issues, lack of prosecution. So there's a lot of issues when it comes to looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women in the United States. And there are grassroots groups, there's advocates, even lawmakers working to address this issue. Washington State recently passed a law where they will address this issue, looking at law enforcement and trying to keep better data. Also, Heidi Heitkamp from introduced Savannah's Act to help look at this as well after a pregnant woman went missing and murdered in North Dakota. So there are a lot of issues when it comes to just looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls, and including the lack of criminal justice in Indian country.
And with regards to the sovereignty issue, how does that play out? How are some courts dealing with these cases differently? Has there been any success in dealing with the sovereignty issue to try to get some of these cases resolved?
So there is a pilot project where there are some tribal courts that are being allowed to prosecute non-Native offenders, including in Arizona. The Pascual Yaqui tribe is working on that. They have successfully prosecuted some non-Indian offenders for domestic violence issues. So there is some work being done there, and tribal leaders, advocates are really working together and even, you know, trying to get laws passed and work with law enforcement and jurisdiction issues as well to try to help address this missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. And there's also work being done to try to look at these cases and try to find ways to create a database.
That's Antonia Gonzalez of National Native News. We're also speaking to Ali Budner of Mountain West News Bureau, Nate Hedgie of Mountain West out of Montana, Ali Budner in Southern Colorado, and KUER's managing editor Julia Ritchie here in Salt Lake City. We welcome your questions and thoughts about the week's top news, especially from a Mountain West perspective. Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. With regards to the plight of Native women, Donna emailed, the 2017 film Wind River is an unpredictable and powerful movie that spotlights problems of violence against women on reservations. I wish this moving and intelligent film, written and directed by Taylor Sheridan, starring Jeremy Renner and Elizabeth Olsen, had gotten more national attention. Let's shift gears and talk about the Interior Department and some issues going on with America's original national park, Yellowstone. Nate Hedgie, the Department of Interior, has been in the news for a few reasons. And most recently, the head of Yellowstone says he was forced out by the Trump administration. What is it that the park superintendent claims happened?
So it's complicated. Essentially, back earlier this spring, he was told that they were going to do this big reorganization in Interior Department, and he was going to get moved from his job at Yellowstone, which, by the way, is like the crown jewel of the Park Service, right? Like, that is like one of the best jobs you can have, is to run Yellowstone. So he was going to be moved from Yellowstone to kind of oversee the parks in the D.C. area, which, great job, not as great as Yellowstone, right? And so he said that He's really close, 66 years old, close to retirement. And so he said, no, I'd rather retire. That other job's going to take 3 to 5 years. I don't have 3 to 5 years. So I'm going to retire, but I want to retire next March because there's some stuff I want to wrap up here. And then during this whole thing, there was a lot of political speculation about, you know, why he was being moved to this lesser job. The Interior Department, especially Secretary Ryan Zinke, has kind of a big thing about loyalty in the Interior Department, and any kind of people who are, or any people that are deemed, I guess, not loyal to the Interior are sometimes forced out. And so here he is about to retire, or he says he's going to retire in March, and then P. Daniel Smith, who is the acting director of the Park Service, comes back at him and he says, listen, Dan, you've got two choices. You're either going to retire in August or you're going to take this job in D.C. But no matter what, come August, you're not going to be running Yellowstone anymore. And Wenk, you know, when I talk to him, this is a pretty savvy politician or bureaucrat. And he was pretty raw and emotional when we spoke over the phone, pretty much essentially saying, I have no idea why this is happening. I can't pinpoint it. I don't know what I did wrong.
Antonia Gonzalez, there's, as I understand it, also some upset among tribal leaders who recently met with representatives from the Department of the Interior. Here is a bit of what Aaron Payment had to say. Aaron Payment is with the Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Indians.
There's no Indian voice, and no offense, but there's nothing. And so you're doing a really good job of trying to put lipstick on this pig earlier by using arguments and justifications and trying to backfill all of this with all of this talk of efficiencies and creating direct paths and all of that, but it's being met in Indian country, and I don't know how you can convey this very clearly to the secretary that my answer, and I think the answer from the Anishinaabe country, is Kaween, no.
That's Aaron Payment of the Sioux Tribe of Chippewa Indians. Antonia Gonzalez, as I understand it, the tribal leaders upset about being out of the reorganization plans at the Department of the Interior and about vacancies at the department that affect tribal communities. Can you tell us a little bit more about those?
So the Interior Department is holding consultations across the country with tribes. The federal government has a trust responsibility to tribes to ensure the well-being, health, wellness of Native American people. And part of this is consulting with tribes, and the Department of the Interior is doing a reorganization right now. And tribes, what we're hearing from tribal leaders, some tribal leaders, is that they're not necessarily opposed to reorganization, but they're curious and a little upset about the process and the way it's being handled of the Interior Department officials saying, we're going to do this with you or without you, kind of, instead of giving true consultation with the tribes. There's no real written proposal. There's some maps put out to show different regions. The Department of the Interior is essentially in charge of the Bureau of Indian Affairs and Indian Education. And so whatever happens in the Interior Department is especially going to impact tribes and tribes across the country. There's more than 500 federally recognized tribes. And so tribal leaders are concerned about the reorganization and lumping different groups together. And so I think what we're hearing from tribal leaders is they really want true consultation with the Interior Department and to make sure that they're not left out and that treaty and trust responsibilities are included when it comes to reorganizing the Department of Interior.
Antonia Gonzalez of National Native News, also speaking to Ali Budner of Mountain West News Bureau. Ali, let me come to you for another story that has a lot of national and really global implications, but that's being felt in unique ways in the Mountain West. The Federal Communications Commission repealed the net neutrality rules that took effect on Monday. Net neutrality had required internet service providers to offer equal access to all web content. Connectivity is already a huge issue in the Mountain West, particularly broadband. The reporters on the Mountain West News Roundup have been covering this for some time. Here is a clip of Tribal Program Administrator Everett Chavez in New Mexico, followed by rancher Katie Vicky in Colorado.
They have to drive up to the top of the hill by the interstate to get a signal on their laptops to do work for school and connecting with the various people that they need to connect with.
If you're on the wrong side of the mountain where you've got the shadow of a hill in the way, then you don't have broadband access. Nowadays, internet accessibility really is a utility. I think if you don't have it, you are at a disadvantage. And I think there's opportunities in life that aren't open to you.
Ali Budner, just to get us started on net neutrality, what's the biggest pain point for most folks in the Mountain West as it relates to broadband?
Yeah, well, I think it's interesting in the Mountain West. This often gets framed as sort of a red-blue issue, split down party lines. And I think in D.C., it often ends up shaking out that way. But if you look at the Mountain West, there's a lot of obviously mountainous regions, valleys, rural areas. And you're seeing actually an issue with access to internet in general out here. And so I think people are feeling really concerned that if ISPs or internet service providers are allowed to clamp down on that even further, that they're going to be affected the most. So you look at red states and right, those are actually the places where people are most concerned.
You had a conversation with Kate Vicky regarding what rolling back net neutrality could mean for communities in the Mountain West. What were some of Katie's biggest concerns?
Yeah, so Kate Vickery, while she lives on a ranch and has horses, she actually works for a software company. So she relies on the internet every day, day in, day out, for her livelihood. And if she doesn't have that connection, or even if it's not fast enough, or if it momentarily lapses, her work suffers. And so she, when she was hunting for a house out there, she and her husband drove around looking, testing out site after site after site, saying, is this going to work? Is this going to work? And it was all about access to the internet. And so, so her concerns are, she did end up finding a property that has a line of sight to the wireless tower where she can get decent internet. But she, she did say that a lot of her neighbors, if they're on the wrong side of the hill, they can't access it. And increasingly in rural areas, as we kind of move into a more and more digital world, access to online education, access to telemedicine or healthcare, even to sign up for like the ACA, things like, even entertainment, honestly. It's just those things rely on the internet more and more these days. So I think it is an issue for people, especially in the Mountain West, who live in, you know, on mountains or in valleys or are far away from cities where there's built out infrastructure. People are concerned right. that there isn't going to be that infrastructure, especially if, you know, especially if the service providers don't have an incentive to do that.
Antonia Gonzalez, could you chime in on broadband as it relates to rural tribal communities in the Rocky Mountains? I'm sure that the need is far more acute there.
Yeah, so advocates, tribes are also worried about this issue. Native Americans also, especially in rural areas, there is a lack of access to high-speed internet. Native people rely on the internet for education, job training, healthcare, getting documents. We talked to some Pueblos here in New Mexico who came up with a solution to bringing high-speed internet to their tribal libraries. They went through the E-Rate program, and four tribes banded together and were able to do this. And so public libraries are a source where people go and they use the internet, but there's a lot of similar issues with other rural communities. As a parent, if your child has homework, the public library is only open to 8 to 5. And if you're a parent who has maybe cell phone data where you can access the internet, maybe you have to drive up to a hill just to get that internet service, or, you know, you have to drive to a nearby town to go to an area and get some internet, maybe from a cafe or something. So there are a lot of similar issues when it comes to rural communities and tribes. And like I said, education, there's a story here in New Mexico at one of the Pueblos where there was a teacher trying to get a higher education. She needed the internet, but there's an after-school program, so there were dozens of kids on there, and so they had to pick and choose who got to use the internet. Does your teacher who's going for her higher education degree get to use it, or some students who are doing their homework? And so these are just some of, you know, looking at this broadband issue impacting tribes, not only here in New Mexico, but across the country.
Yeah, clearly that's, I'm sure, one of the issues that any number of the Native American political candidates running for office now would be eager to advocate for. And to that point, we did get a question about Native American politics that, Julia Ritchie, I'd love you to respond to. Catherine tweeted, "Racial gerrymandering affects Native peoples too. Recent cases in San Juan County, Utah, point to this." Julia?
Yeah, in 2012, the Navajo Nation sued San Juan County over their lines that they drew for their county commission. So they have a 3-member county commission. They're very powerful. And for the last like half century or so, whites have held a majority on those commissions and school board seats. So just in the last year, a federal court judge ordered that those lines had to be redrawn. This November is the first year that they would go into effect and could significantly shift the politics in that part of the state. So it's a big deal. San Juan is, of course, appealing the decision. And I'm not sure where that stands right now, but that could really change things in that area for the Navajo.
Antonia, before we keep moving, what's your view on this comment on racial gerrymandering? Since you are a member of the Navajo Nation, are you seeing this kind of gerrymandering playing out in more widespread ways? Is there effort to undo or challenge this gerrymandering? What are you seeing?
Well, I think that when we're looking at voting and voting issues and looking at communities, there's still a lot of racial tensions between border towns, you know, just not access to the polls, but a lot of different issues that advocates, tribes have long been working for and still are working for today. There are a lot of cases across the country, in Indian country, looking at different voting issues, including in North Dakota, where there's a law, Native Americans are challenging the voting law there, saying it's discriminatory because of the way they're looking at IDs. There are Native people across the country who do not have identification that is allowing them to go to the polls. So there's a lawsuit saying that your tribal documents, your tribal IDs, a letter from your tribe, and also PO boxes. There's allowing people to show their proof of residency to go to the polls and vote. So there are a lot of different issues when we're looking at voting among Native people.
A few more stories we'd like to get to before we wrap up the roundup for today. Julia Ritchie, let me come back to you. There's been some interesting news this week out of Utah and the LGBT community. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah urged compassion for LGBT youth. He used his time on the Senate floor on Wednesday to address Utah's recent rash of youth suicides. Here is part of what Senator Hatch had to say.
Mr. President, the prevalence of suicide, especially among LGBT teens, is a serious problem that requires national attention. No one should ever feel less because of their gender identity or sexual orientation. LGBT youth deserve our unwavering love and support. They deserve our validation and the assurance that not only is there a place for them in this society, but that it is far better off because of them.
Part of what Utah Republican Senator Orrin Hatch said on the floor of the Senate on Wednesday. Now, Julia, I'm confused by this.
Right.
A few weeks ago, Senator Hatch applauded a Supreme Court decision that allowed a Colorado baker not to create a wedding cake for a same-sex couple. I still recall that Orrin Hatch was one of the most strident critics of the legal fight against California's same-sex marriage ban, Proposition 8. Where did this come from?
I think it's safe to say that Senator Hatch is wrapping up a four-decade career in the Senate, and his thinking, to be generous, has evolved on LGBT issues. I don't think the LGBT community would consider him an ally necessarily, but that doesn't mean that he hasn't shifted somewhat in the way he's talking about this issue, especially because suicides are such an issue in Utah. We're, I think, fifth highest now, according to the CDC, and he's been making this push for a national suicide hotline like 911. So I think his speech kind of correlates to this last push. He's thinking about his legacy now. And, you know, he's spoken out against the Trump administration when he put in place the ban on transgender people in the military. So, you know, I guess he has a mixed record at this point. But, you know, it remains to be seen how he'll be seen by the LGBT community.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. I could see on the one hand critics saying, well, it took you long enough.
Right.
Where have you been all this time when we needed you now that you're leaving the Senate? On the other hand, I could also see people saying, well, better late than never. It's about time you came around. I mean, how is this playing here?
You know, I think there are a lot of cynics, and I think a lot of people are ready to see Hatch go at this point. But I also think that, you know, people can change over the course of their career. And he has definitely, I don't know, he's softened his tone, but I'm not sure that, you know, he'll be getting awards from Lambda and other groups.
Yeah, if you are LGBT living in Utah, we'd love to know what you think of some of the stories that have moved this week. There have been quite a few, that for one. Also, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints announced a change with its genealogical arm, Family Search. Family records, very detailed family records, are a very important matter in the Mormon faith. And Family Search released a statement announcing that its database will include same-sex couples and same-sex parents. But Julia, I don't think this is a change in the doctrine on homosexuality with the LDS Church, right?
Right. So this is kind of harder to parse, and I'm not sure I'm the best person to speak to this. The policy has been for a long time. It's been this one way, but then they've issued statements and messages that, again, have softened their tone on certain issues regarding this. Again, like you say, ancestry is a big deal here. So I'm sure this will play pretty well. I think people are in support of it.
One more story affecting the LGBT community in Utah. This morning, the Salt Lake Tribune reported that LGBT groups are at least a step closer to being able to participate in a very large, very well-known 4th of July parade in Provo, Utah, not far from Salt Lake. The reasons for them not being allowed to participate seem different depending on who you ask. On one side, the organizers seem to say it's because there were issues with the application or the size of the floats they were going to use. The LGBT groups say they weren't allowed to participate because they're LGBT. Where does this stand?
This was a controversy last year. They had accepted an LGBT youth resource center to march, and then the night before they said, no, you can't march, and that caused a lot of heartburn. And then they did it again this year, except there were five LGBT groups that applied, and they said none of them fit the parameters of the parade. They weren't patriotic enough. They have very strict parameters to march in this parade.
Not patriotic enough?
Yeah. They have to, basically justify what their float is going to do to advance the theme of the parade, which is United We Stand. They got a lot more flack this year for it, and they received hundreds of thousands of dollars from the county and state for this parade. And so mounting public pressure basically put them back in the room with these groups, and they said, okay, we'll put you on a float this year, and they'll have a banner that says something to the effect of, like, United We Stand, Utah's LGBT community.
A few more stories we definitely want to discuss before our time is up. One of the big ones that you mentioned were wildfires that you told us that you wanted us to discuss. Are the Western wildfires burning? And Ali Budner, I wonder if we could start with you and the fires that are burning in Colorado. Where do those stand and where are they burning the hottest right now?
Well, my understanding is that, there was a large fire near Durango in the southwestern part of the state, and I actually don't know at this very moment what the percent containment is on that, but there were quite a few evacuations and structures damaged there, and there actually, already this year, have been a number just near Colorado Springs. That actually is the only update I have on the fires in Colorado at the moment. But people are very worried that this is already early for the season, and that the fires have already burned pretty big and pretty hot this year.
Is there anything in particular, Ali, that's making this season different from others? I mean, are there factors at play that have people particularly worried?
Well, there are a number of things. I mean, the obviously, you know, the spring and early summer have been some record heat temperatures. So we've had hot and dry, and then also the wind. That's kind of the recipe for bad wildfire season. And basically, you know, there's just a ton of fuel. There's been this beetle, bark beetle infestation in a lot of the forests throughout the Mountain West, and that has just created an enormous amount of trees that are just ready to burn and in mass quantity. So I think it's that combination, really, around here, right, in Colorado Springs. It's when the wind picks up and it's warm, you get worried.
Nate Hedgey, what's the outlook like in Montana for this season?
Not great. So last year we had one of our most severe wildfire seasons on record. It was definitely one of the most expensive, and it just ate into our state budget. And it's interesting to see, because the wildfires played into, or essentially, like, we lost a bunch of money from our state budget, and that in turn hurt our health services. So we're seeing mental health services getting impacted by wildfires. And then the governor yesterday just came out, or the state just came out and said they've got about $4 million to fight wildfires until June. So we're severely short on cash to fight wildfires in the state, and it looks like, even though we've had a ton of rain and big snowpack, which always means normally that you're not going to have a severe wildfire season in July, yeah, and August, it's supposed to dry up like that, and we could just have another big burn year.
Hey, Ali, I know we're very short on time, but I wonder if you could tell us briefly about the Senate version of the Farm Bill. It contains language that would legalize commercialization of hemp. What would that mean for Colorado, briefly, before we got to go?
Yeah, so that was the big news this week, that Mitch McConnell put language to legalize hemp into the Senate version of the Farm Bill, and it passed the Agriculture Committee. So people here in Colorado are, you know, I think they're tentatively excited. In Colorado, we've had a head start on it because as a state, we legalized it for commercial and research purposes in 2014. So it really has had some time to get off the ground. That said, similar in a lot of ways with marijuana in state versus federal, we've had issues with, you know, dealing with a crop that is legal at the state level but illegal at the federal level.
Ali Budner,
so if it's legalized
Colorado
federally, that's good.
Ali Budner, Southern Colorado reporter for the Mountain West News Bureau. Antonia Gonzalez, anchor and producer for National Native News. Nate Hedgey, Montana reporter for Mountain West News Bureau. And Julia Ritchie, managing editor of KUER. Thank you all very much for being with us.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Gelmar CLR. Whatever you call your home, Gelmar knows you take great pride in keeping it clean. That's where CLR comes in. CLR dissolves calcium, lime, and rust all around the house using natural ingredients, not harsh chemicals. It even carries the EPA's Safer Choice seal. Keep your little piece of the planet looking its best with CLR, making the world a little cleaner.
There's a new way to hear Morning Edition, All Things Considered, and all your favorite programs. Just ask your smart device to play NPR. Listen to your local station anytime, like this. Hey, smart device, play NPR.
We're rounding out this week a long way from our normal home in D.C. and 9,000 miles away from Singapore, where this happened.
My meeting with Chairman Kim was honest, direct, and productive. We got to know each other well in a very confined period of time, under very strong circumstance. We're prepared to start a new history, and we're ready to write a new chapter between our nations.
The text of that chapter seems somewhat up for grabs. Beyond the photo op, reaction to President Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un has been mixed. His fans are convinced it's a breakthrough worthy of a Nobel Peace Prize. Lawmakers of various political stripes have been less effusive.
With a leader who is as ruthless as Kim Jong-un is, has nuclear weapons and ICBMs that can threaten the U.S., photo ops will not do.
This is a great public relations effort by Kim Jong-un, and I think people recognize that. I think everyone within the administration and Congress approaches this with skepticism and caution.
Well, they've promised to give up their nuclear weapons. They've done this twice. Why should we consider this different? I think they believe President Trump is different in this regard, that if they don't give up their weapons, we're going to have a military conflict to end their program.
Lindsey Graham, Bob Corker, and Chuck Schumer reacting there. Clearly, we need to spend time talking about North Korea, but there's other important news to get to as well. And we are spending this hour almost at the four corners of the world, including with David Rennie joining us on the line from his new home in Beijing. He's now the Beijing bureau chief for The Economist. David, welcome back to the Roundup.
Hello.
Back at our home base in Washington, Indira Lakshmanan is a columnist for the Boston Globe and chair in journalism ethics at the Poynter Institute. Hi, Indira.
Hi, Joshua. Great to hear you.
And joining us here at KUER in Salt Lake City is Matthew LaPlante. He's a sports science and global issues writer and associate professor of journalism at Utah State University. Matthew, welcome to 1A.
Thanks so much.
Indira, let me start with you with just the basic question. How big a deal was this meeting? Can we say for sure that we gained something significant from this? Was this mostly just a photo op? What's your read?
Yes to all of those. I mean, on the positive side, there's no question that having this summit and the two sides going off and saying, yay, victory, we're going to have denuclearization and we're going to reduce the tensions and maybe even limit exercises on the Korean Peninsula is much better than the fear we had 6 months ago of a so-called bloody nose strike. You know, there were some in the Pentagon who were supposedly, we know, who were imagining ideas of some sort of limited strike on North Korea, or even the president's own words of fire and fury that he was going to rain down upon North Korea. So this is better than that. On the other hand, it is above all a propaganda boost for both sides. Trump, as you mentioned at the top, is angling for a Nobel Peace Prize and casting himself as this historic figure and a daring peacemaker. And for Kim Jong-un, I mean, this is just a massive propaganda windfall. Getting to have dozens of his DPRK, North Korean flags, which are never seen anywhere, I might add, next to ours, flying on equal footing with the stars and stripes, himself on equal footing with the most powerful leader in the world, which is what he's always wanted, and images of him with Trump, and with Trump, by the way, saluting a North Korean military official, which it is not the practice of American presidents to salute any foreign military officer. All of those things have already been aired on North Korean state television and used as propaganda. So both of the things you said are true.
David Rennie, I think Aaron sums up kind of the core question, what she wrote on our website, the1a.org. Aaron writes, "No one I know of is arguing that peace would be bad. We're arguing about whether anything of real substance was achieved at the summit this week. It appears that the only thing achieved was Trump shook hands with the most brutal dictator in the world and saluted a North Korean general. That agreement they signed was some weak tea." What about that, David Rennie? Is it fair to say materially, as the president said this week, that the world is in some way a safer place?
It's very hard to say that he did a deal that takes us actually any further than previous agreements that America reached with North Korea, I mean, on a couple of occasions, and then North Korea broke them. So if you're looking narrowly at what was agreed in Singapore, it's very hard to say this is a dramatic win. I think what's really interesting sitting here in Beijing is looking at how happy the Chinese are. They think that this was a huge win for them. And I think in there you can see the seeds of a real doubt that should strike people in America. Why is China so happy? Well, China's really happy because they heard Donald Trump say that when America has military exercises with South Korea, that that costs a huge amount of money and is provocative. Well, that's exactly what the Chinese have said for years, and Americans have said that's absolutely unfair. It's a completely reasonable thing to have those exercises. Why else is China happy? Well, China was under a huge amount of pressure from Trump to impose very tough sanctions on North Korea. China didn't like to do that. It was bad for business, but it was also they worried that it might destabilize North Korea and cause a collapse there, which was really the last thing they wanted. China now has already started saying, let's ease these sanctions maybe. Maybe it's time now. We're all talking, isn't it lovely? Let's start easing the sanctions. So if these talks go wrong, America's ability to turn around to China, which of course controls 90% of trade with North Korea, and say, this isn't going well, we need to start ratcheting those sanctions back up. I think Donald Trump has lost almost all of that leverage, and Chinese analysts have told me this week they're not going to increase those sanctions again.
Matthew LaPlante, I wonder what your read is of the relationship now between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. To hear him tell it, he and the North Korean leader, who he had formerly called Little Rocket Man, got along really well. President Trump made a kind of surprise appearance on Fox and Friends this morning. Here's part of what the president said.
We had good chemistry. You haven't had any rockets shut up in the air for 7 months. You haven't had any research. They just blew up their test site. They're blowing up their engine test site for ballistic missiles. He's giving us back our great heroes who died, as you know. We're getting the remains back. And I've had so many people, so many parents, so many fathers and daughters and sons asking me, please, please.
Right.
This is during the campaign and after.
Right.
I say, I don't have exactly a good relationship. Anyway, during the meeting, and we really did hit it off, during the, you know, good chemistry.
That's President Trump speaking this morning on Fox and Friends. Matthew LaPlante, what's your read of whether either leader is willing to trust the other more or less or the same after this summit?
I think that what we have seen is the ability for these people to talk to each other. And that's great. I don't think that Kim Jong-un trusts President Trump any further than he can throw him. And I'm not sure that President Trump feels any differently about North Korea's dictator. But they're in the same room. They're talking together. That's a start. But what just really baffles me, though, is this idea that, like, after lambasting past administrations for just, like, the very idea of talking to U.S. adversaries, President Trump seems to say, like, oh, I see the value now in some civil dialogue. What happens from that, though? I don't know, because the guy's he's proven not to be stable in terms of, like, who he decides are his friends and who he decides are his enemies.
Quite a few of you commented on one particular aspect of the meeting. Brian in New Hampshire writes, huh? Trump has one meeting with Kim and there's no longer a nuclear threat? I'm sorry, but this does not pass the straight face test. Trump gave Kim a propaganda bonanza that he will now exploit for years. Politics Watcher also wrote on our website, the1a.org, let's talk about Trump's idiotic propaganda video. Mindlessly violating Destiny Pictures' trademark was just the first of the jaw-dropping sequence of blunders, missteps, and failures. But Trump was super proud of it. It was about him. Indira, I did want to ask you about the optics of that. Reporters in Singapore saw a video that some of them initially thought was North Korean propaganda that ended up being produced by the White House. Here's a clip from that video.
7 billion people inhabit planet Earth. Of those alive today, only a small number will leave a lasting impact. And only the very few will make decisions or take actions that renew their homeland and change the course of history. History may appear to repeat itself for generations.
Indira, I wonder what your read was on that video. That quite a few of the reporters were not sure was a propaganda video and whom it was from.
So many reactions to that, Joshua. First of all, I would urge all listeners who haven't seen it to go online and click on this video and watch it because it is stunning. It really, I was based in Asia for 7 years in China and have been to North Korea as a journalist. And this reeks of propaganda videos from totalitarian regimes. I was stunned to discover quite a ways into the video that there was the whitehouse.gov logo on the top right, because it truly looked like a regime propaganda thing. And again, you know, this goes back to the whole thing of giving Kim Jong-un this propaganda freebie. It's, you know, the agreement itself is completely vague. You can't even call it an agreement. And having covered the Iran nuclear negotiations, which went on for years, I just want to stress here, the key to denuclearization is that it be complete, verifiable, and irreversible. And that's why it took so long to get the Iran deal. And this is none of those things at this point. This is just an idea.
David, I wonder if you could answer a question from B. Sean, who wrote on our website, the1a.org. Does the panel have any insight into the views of John Bolton concerning the rapprochement with North Korea and his relationship with the Secretary of State concerning this and other issues? Seems they're at cross purposes. And what's the capability of the United States to deploy nuclear weapons in the Korean theater? Does denuclearization include the removal of that capacity? What about other nations, such as China and Russia? David, I think Bishan is kind of in bullet points broken out all of the issues at the core of this whole summit that everyone was asking going into it. And I think that a lot of people are still asking coming out of it.
That's right. So John Bolton's a shorthand, if you like, for the people who think that there is no trusting a regime like North Korea, that what you have to do is basically try and achieve regime change. That was John Bolton's position with Iran. It's his position with North Korea. Before he joined the government again, he was basically writing op-eds for a long time saying that North Korea could never be trusted and that it was time to have regime change. Now, remember, of course, that's countries like China's absolute worst nightmare. Why? Because you've got 30,000 American troops in South Korea. And in China's absolute worst nightmare, you have North Korea fall, you have a reunification of the Korean Peninsula, and then you have Marines in Oakley sunglasses on the banks of the Yalu River looking at China. That's their worst nightmare. So what Donald Trump has done is he's sided very much with the Chinese view that we have to try kind of sunshine and light and warmth and offering the North Koreans, as Indra said, weird propaganda videos about how happy and rich they'll be if they go his way. So he's not going the John Bolton route. The listener also asked a good question about nuclear weapons. And this is obviously when the North Koreans talk about denuclearization, that's what they mean. They don't just mean their own weapons, they mean America too. America hasn't had nuclear weapons on South Korean soil since the last days of George H.W. Bush. America took some tactical weapons out of South Korea in 1992 as a kind of confidence-building measure to woo the North Koreans then. But what really offends the North Koreans is that every now and then the Americans fly things like B-52 bombers up from Guam past the coasts of North Korea. And those are what they call nuclear-capable bombers. And the American practice forever has been never to confirm or deny that planes like that are carrying nuclear weapons.
I wonder, Matthew, in the long view, if we could just kind of zoom out from all of the criticism for a moment. I mean, late-night comedy hosts are going to mock the president for this, for sure. Op-ed writers can and have been writing some very sharp and salty op-eds about this. But I wonder if we just flip this around, if this works, if this odd form of diplomacy works in terms of lessening the threat from North Korea, what difference does it make whether this week's summit was a diplomatic oddity? Does it really matter?
No, I don't think it does matter. I think sometimes when you're playing a game of chess, you've got to give up a pawn to put your queen into a better position, right? But if this is a chess game, and this is what does matter, the U.S. didn't just give up a pawn this week. The U.S. gave up a rook. It gave up a knight. It gave up something more valuable. It offered legitimacy and concessions and a literal slap on the back to a guy who is, for all intents and purposes, holding 25 million people in slavery. That's – if this is a long game, we're starting behind.
We should also note, Indira, that no one – seems to have brought up, or at least the president seems not to have brought up, human rights in this meeting with Kim Jong-un. It's a topic that the administration doesn't want to draw too much attention to right now. We know from the previous Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, that this administration can have a more transactional view as it relates to human rights and things of that nature. Does that mean that it's off the table? Is there still the possibility that that could come up later? What about these other human rights issues?
Look, to be fair, across parties, you know, both parties have had a transactional view of human rights. And this has been, you know, I've written this again and again about how Republicans or Democrats campaign on saying things like butchers of Beijing and China is violating human rights. And then once they come into office, suddenly they're a lot softer. Now, I will say North Korea is in a whole separate category from China. It runs gulags in which 100,000 of its people are estimated to be imprisoned and kept in animal-like conditions. You know, Kim Jong-un himself executed his own uncle, put out a hit and assassinated his own brother in a foreign country. His regime was responsible for the death of that American student, Otto Warmbier, who came back last year in a coma and died soon after having been beaten in custody. So when we hear our president say, you know, the president and leader of the free world saying he trusts me, I trust him, it reeks of naivete. And it reminds me of George W. Bush saying that he looked into Vladimir Putin's eyes and saw his soul. I've, you know, reporting from North Korea and also reporting from South Korea, you know, in South Korea, you get to meet these defectors who tell you stories that just raise the hair on your skin. They live in horrific conditions, North Koreans who've been forced into these camps. You know, the whole country is basically a Potemkin village. When they bring in journalists, they show you a fake facade. People have to sneak out, pay money to get out with brokers. And the stories that we've all written, those of us who've met North Korean defectors, are just so horrible that it's really disturbing to hear our own president sound like an apologist. When he was asked about human rights violations and abuse of his own people, his response to an American journalist was that Kim Jong-un is tough, but that his people love him and show fervor. Well, the reason they show fervor is because if you don't, you get sent off to effectively a gulag or perhaps executed. It's absurd and upsetting to hear an American leader say that.
Speaking of North Korean defectors, by the way, just to point your attention to it, if you missed Steve Inskeep's conversation this morning with Sungju Lee, you should go back and find it. He was a defector from North Korea. You'll find that conversation online at npr.org. Matthew?
You know, our human rights message isn't just about wagging fingers at other leaders. It's about offering people hope. And I think one of the things that's been largely undiscussed this week is what Kim is going to be doing in North Korea with these photos and videos of this momentous meeting. If we can forget for a moment that he's already using these to legitimize his dictatorial leadership on the world stage, consider what this looks like in North Korea for anybody who's so much as like dreaming about fighting against this brutal regime. I don't think there's probably all that much hope to begin with for freedom and liberty and democracy. But what there was this week, we helped snuff out.
Plenty more we could discuss about North Korea, and we will be coming back to this in the days and weeks to come. But there's a lot more we should discuss in the roundup with David Rennie of The Economist, Matthew Plant of Utah State University, and Indira Lakshmanan of the Boston Globe and the Poynter Institute. David, I'm coming your way from Beijing because we definitely have to talk about the tariffs with China. That heated up just today. The president approved tens of billions of dollars in tariffs on Chinese products. Tell us what these tariffs are targeting.
So once again, we're slightly in the kind of threat rather than action, because we were told that we're going to get these tariffs announced today. And clearly, that's really bad news for the Chinese. They're very shocked. They put out some reasonably strong statements. But actually, once again, it's a kind of threat hanging over them, because these are not actually going to be imposed in terms of money charged on Chinese imports until the 6th of July. So you can see that the Americans are hoping again that the Chinese back down. I think what's interesting is that the Chinese are not turning on the full taps of their propaganda kind of rage machine. We've seen the Chinese very capable. They have a completely state-controlled media. And when they want to put the pressure on a country like South Korea recently or Japan, they can really turn the taps on and make the people very, very angry. They're actually going quite gently with Donald Trump. Most Chinese people, if you talk to them in the street, they think Donald Trump is a pretty cool guy. You know, he's got lots of money, pretty daughter. They don't know much about the fact that he's sort of fighting China, because the Chinese government, I think, is giving itself room to do a deal. And so they're not actually turning the Chinese public against Donald Trump, because if they did that and then they do a deal, they'd have some explaining to do as to why they'd just done a deal with this terrible guy. So it's interesting that it's more kind of in sorrow than in anger, the Chinese government response so far. So you can see that they are hoping that they can calm this down and do a deal.
David, give us a sense of the administration's rationale for these tariffs. Is this a continuation of the argument about China profiting at the expense of America's intellectual property as part of its economic future plans?
Exactly that. So if you take it at face value, the statement that we saw today, both from the White House, but then from the U.S. Trade Representative, Robert Lighthizer, was that these have been carefully crafted to target Chinese products, which basically involves stolen American technology. They use this section of the trade law, Section 301, which is about things like American companies being told, if you want to sell stuff in China, you have to hand over your crown jewels in terms of your technology and your trade secrets. And so you can see, if it's a long list of products, but the ones that really count, if you talk to the experts, are things that involve chips and semiconductors, those really high-end, high-tech products. And this is basically a warning that people shouldn't be making these in China. This is not just a message to the Chinese, it's actually a message to American business too. If you make your best products in China, you could get yourself into a lot of trouble with this government.
Indira Lakshmanan, do you see any connection in terms of potential spillover effects between this trade war, tariff fight, and what we were just talking about with North Korea, denuclearization? You know, David mentioned that Beijing has huge sway over Pyongyang, 90% of the economic activity. Where could this go?
I absolutely do see potential crossover, Joshua. It's a good question, because China, as David said earlier, you know, was one of the biggest winners out of this summit concretely, because they don't want their neighbor to collapse. Remember, North Korea has exactly one ally in the world, and a reluctant ally at that, in Beijing. And the last thing that China has wanted, and this has been true for 20 years or more, is they don't want their neighbor to collapse, because then they're going to have a humanitarian crisis on their hands, with hundreds of thousands of people spilling over the border into China, and they don't want that. So, you know, China was key to this summit happening, because the U.S. needed China to cut back on its trade with North Korea, to enforce sanctions. At the same time, China's playing its own hand, its own game. It had key meetings with Kim Jong-un before, you know, the summit between North and South Korea, and even before this U.S.-North Korea summit. We don't know what was said. Chinese officials couldn't be happier with Trump's pledge to halt joint military exercises. I want to say one quick thing about this. Trump used the word end war games. That's, and everyone was shocked and horrified that the implication of withdrawing 28,500 U.S. troops. But the fact is, you can finesse that by continuing joint military exercises, but just not having the formal war games. But China could certainly retaliate by stopping to help us, stopping to cooperate on the North Korea front by easing up, loosening sanctions. I think there's absolute possibility for the trade war issue to spill over into other diplomacy. That has always been the case in the China-U.S. relationship.
There's a whole lot more I'd like us to discuss before we are out of time with the roundup. And Indira, let me stick with you for a moment with regards to Mexico, which is less than a month away from its national elections. The lead up to these elections has been murderous and bloody. There are more than 40 candidates who have been murdered since the fall, 40 candidates. One congressional contender was shot in the back of the head while taking a selfie with a supporter. Three female political candidates were shot dead in one 24-hour period. Indira, what is going on in Mexico?
It is horrifying. And as you said, Joshua, since September, it's been 43 candidates for office who've been killed, but 113 politicians overall. Three female politicians and candidates were shot dead in just 24 hours earlier this month. I mean, look, there are a lot of factors here. Mexico, you know, the drug war in Mexico has fueled all sorts of political violence. There are are, there's a whole overlay between corruption, drugs, politics. But I also feel like there's a back to the future quality in this election, because the candidate who is, according to all the polls, leading the race, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, this is his third time running for president. And I covered his last presidential run, which was in 2006. Well, his two times ago, his first presidential run in 2006, I was in Mexico for that, and he lost by less than a percentage point. It led to all sorts of comparisons to hanging chads, and he, you know, disputed the results and staged his own alternate swearing-in ceremony. 6 years later, he ran again and lost. He was always the leftist, and now, interestingly enough, he's coming on strong as this populist with an almost Trumpian sound to him. He's not a fan of free trade. He works up his base. He's upset about globalization, but he's also been very short on the details and specifics. So you have this strange overlay between terrible political violence and intimidation and this kind of like everything old is new again aspect of, you know, the actual candidates running for office.
Matthew LaPlante, what's your read on what's happening in Mexico, particularly who the perpetrators of this violence might be? What's going on?
It's a perfect storm, right? I think, Indira just said what we've got going on right now is in the midst of a highly contentious election. We've also got a country that's been beset by a drug trade war. We've got corruption that is just running amok. We have gangs. We have a flow of migrants and immigrants and human traffickers that are coming through there. And everybody is fighting for a piece of territory. And everybody is fighting for, after this election, being able to maintain the power centers that they have controlled. The short answer is everybody. And it's horrific. It really is.
One more thing, Indira, I wanted to ask you about this before we have to pause. Do we get the sense that the candidates feel hopeful that they can make waves with this violence, that they can do something about it? Or is this just kind of the cost of running for office in Mexico now, briefly?
It's the worst that we've seen. I think it's in the same way that there have been such attacks on journalists, and Mexico is one of the most dangerous places to be a journalist right now. I think it's a very bad situation. The Mexicans I've talked to are not hopeful. They're scared.
Mesh One tweeted, "Can't talk about the world without the World Cup in Russia. More people are watching than any topic you touch on today. Au contraire! We are talking about the World Cup next with Indira Lakshmanan, David Rennie, and our resident football fan, Matthew LaPlante. Stay close."
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting your short list of candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air. We do long-form interviews with the people behind the best books, pop culture, journalism, and more, so you can get to know the people whose work you love. You'll find Fresh Air on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Football, soccer, football, whatever you call it, fans of the sport all over the world are celebrating the World Cup, which kicked off yesterday. Russia is hosting this year. That decision is still controversial for FIFA, but the Russians, not to be stopped by accusations of corruption, are doing well so far.
Pass, Golovin, into the box, header, Russia's on the board! Krasinski!
That's Russian player Yuri Krasinski scoring the first goal of the Cup yesterday. Russia beat Saudi Arabia 5-0. And somewhat poetically, it was announced this week that North America, the U.S., Canada, and Mexico, will host the World Cup in 2026. Matthew LaPlante, that's kind of awkward for a few reasons, especially given the tensions between the U.S. and our NAFTA neighbors. What impact do we think that a NAFTA World Cup would have on the other diplomacy that's going on right now between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico?
Oh, let's be totally optimistic and Pollyanna-ish. This is great, right? I mean, like, at a time in which most of the dialogue about our three nations is about war or walls and trade wars, and there's such hateful rhetoric, and you know, the Trump administration is calling the Trudeau administration, traitorous. This represents a clear determination on the part of sports fans to work together, to come together, to do something amazing. I'm gonna bask in that for a while, and then I'm gonna acknowledge that, like, in the reality, in the grand scheme of things, it's a blip, right? But it's gonna be cool.
It's gonna be cool.
It's gonna be cool.
What about this year's World Cup? We talked earlier this week about the impact of Vladimir Putin and Russia hosting this year. How much of a victory, Matthew, do you think that is, and what? How does that reflect on the governing body, FIFA?
Yeah, I think it reflects poorly on FIFA, and I think FIFA's choices. Look, FIFA has a really bad record right now in terms of LGBT rights and women's sports equality, and that I think is also a promise of what we're calling the NAFTA Cup, the joint World Cup in 2026 is maybe we have the promise of having something that resembles a woke cup after, like, two consecutive cups in countries that have really bad LGBT rights records. There's already reports of fans being LGBT fans being attacked in Russia this week. FIFA's got to do better. They have to do better. I mean, they've tried to do better on the corruption thing. But they've got to do better on choosing the people who they lift up and celebrate and give this amazing event to.
Yeah, hooliganism on a lot of different levels. Racist, sexist, homophobic has been an issue, I think, with soccer in general, not just with FIFA. Can you clarify a little bit more about the LGBT aspect of what FIFA has been dealing with? I don't think that's gotten a whole lot of attention.
Sure. Well, I mean, look, Russia in general is not the friendliest place for gays, lesbians, bisexuals, transgender people. It's not. Late last year, FIFA passed on messages from Russian officials that said, like, hey, look, if you're gay and you come to the World Cup, don't act gay. That's horrible. It's absolutely horrific. And this all started because FIFA chose a country that has a really bad record on this. There are a lot of LGBT soccer fans, and they deserve to be able to go to games and feel safe and hold hands and celebrate like everybody else.
David Rennie, what about the reflection of this on Donald Trump? Unless something remarkable happens, if he decided, for example, not to run and then to run later, he's likely not going to be president in 2026 when this so-called NAFTA World Cup is held, but is securing it is the first World Cup for the U.S. since 1994. It's happening during his administration. Is this part of his legacy, particularly his foreign policy legacy anyway?
Well, obviously, it's going to be President Ivanka by 2026, isn't it? So there's going to be the Trump family legacy, I think we can say. He put out a sort of series of friendly tweets saying how marvelous this is. I mean, I think it shows, the really sad thing is the idea of having a joint U.S.-Mexico World Cup was actually a guy I know called Arturo Sarracan, who was the Mexican ambassador to America, who was a kind of absolute exemplar of a whole generation of Mexicans who really thought that they could use this World Cup to show that there was a new relationship between Mexico and America that was going to be more equal, it was going to be more friendly. It was building on that sort of heritage of NAFTA. And you see just how far down we have come. The real disaster in what could have been a great relationship. I should say, I'm sitting here in Beijing overlooking one of the main football stadiums in soccer stadiums, you would say, which is Beijing Guoan team. The Chinese are feeling a bit sore because they never, ever get into the World Cup. It's a completely soccer-mad country, but they never qualify. And I think the tragic thing I saw today was a piece by Xinhua, the state news agency, saying that at least there are advertisements of Chinese brands in the stadium in Moscow. And so that's a big thing for Chinese soccer fans, they were suggesting.
Did you just translate the word football to soccer? Did you just do an English to American translation, David?
Well, you know, Joshua, I used to live in the States for 6 years. We used to meet in your studio in DC. So I'm trying to remember my manners and say soccer.
Well,
I can say
zhuqiu.
That's how they said in Chinese. Zhuqiu.
Oh, wow. Well, that you would definitely have to translate. Thank you for your sensitivities from having spent time in our studio. We do want to spend time with someone else who just joined us in the studio, sitting beside Indira, someone who's got some insight into a story we've been following on the Roundup, the civil war in Yemen. That dates back to 2011, and by many estimates, the conflict has already put the lives of 8 million Yemeni people at risk. This week, the crisis got worse. An Arab military coalition led by the Saudis attacked Yemen's main port. Al-Hudaydia is the main entry point for all humanitarian and commercial goods into Yemen. It's this vital pipeline for food and medicine and fuel. Joining us from our home base in D.C. is Scott Paul. He just got back from Yemen, and he works for Oxfam. Scott, welcome to 1A.
Thanks for having me with us.
Paint us a picture of what you saw on the ground in Yemen. What's going on there?
Well, Yemen is suffering an appalling humanitarian crisis. There's actually now 22 million people who need some form of aid or protection to survive. And about 8.5 million of those people are right on the verge of starvation, just on the verge of famine. And you can't be a supporter of human rights and not be offended when you go to Yemen, because there is food in the markets at the moment. You can buy most of what you need to live if you have the money. And there's a handful of people who are making a huge amount of money off of this war, and they're doing just fine. And then there's the 3/4 of the population that really are just barely scraping by, sometimes managing to earn a living, and even then having to make impossible choices with the little money that they earn.
Is there any way out for people who are caught up in this conflict, particularly the ones who are near this port that got attacked?
Well, the port's going to impact things in two ways, the upcoming offensive at Hodeida. There's 600,000 people who live in the city itself. And what we're likely to see is the kind of street fighting that we've seen over the past few years in Mosul or Aleppo, really brutal fighting that's going to make life difficult for everybody who lives there and everybody who lives near there. And a lot of people are going to have to flee for their lives if they survive. But the second degree effects are in some ways just as bad. Yemen's crisis, the nature of it is just that, as I said, there's food in the markets and there's medical supplies in some places, but very little income generating opportunities. People just can't afford it. And so when if this lifeline gets cut, if the commercial and humanitarian imports are disrupted in any way, some of the places that are more remote aren't going to be able to receive those goods. And even the places where they can still get food or fuel from other places, the price is going to skyrocket. And it's going to push a lot of those 8.4 million people over the line into famine, where there are going to be a lot of people dying and suffering from horrific malnutrition-related disease.
We're speaking to Scott Paul, humanitarian policy lead for Oxfam, about the situation in Yemen. Scott, we did get a question about what's going on there from Jared, who wrote on our website, the1a.org. The Saudis seem to believe if they kill enough Yemeni civilians and make their lives as miserable as possible, that the Houthi military will give up or at least go away. That strategy has not worked since the Middle Ages and is certainly failing now. The U.S. should focus exclusively on the eastern part of Yemen, where bands affiliated with Al-Qaeda have control. These are our enemy, not the Houthis. Scott, it seems that this Saudi-led attack has some backing from the U.S. How much, if at all, do you expect anyone in Washington to start raising questions about how involved the U.S. should be?
Well, some of the questions are being raised already. Earlier this week, there was a letter from a senior bipartisan group of 10 senators stating pretty clearly that they don't want to see this attack go forward. An even stronger letter was sent by a group of bipartisan members of Congress on the House side. The questions are being answered. And even the administration has raised its concerns about this strategy. The problem is that the United States is one of the only countries, and maybe the only country, that can actually stop this attack. But in order to do it, it's going to have to make more than just concerned statements. It's going to have to demonstrate that not only does it oppose the attack, but that there are concrete implications in the U.S.-Emirati and U.S.-Saudi relationships if they choose to go forward. And they haven't done that yet.
Before we keep moving, Indira Lakshmanan, I wonder what your thoughts on this, particularly whether or not this is another proxy war that we're seeing, with Yemen being used as a battleground for other interests.
Well, it absolutely has been a proxy war. As you say, the conflict has its roots in 2011. The actual fighting started a little more than 3 years ago. And the reason that the Saudis and the Emiratis and others got involved was as a out of fear that their nemesis, Iran, and this is part of the Sunni-Shia conflict, would side with the Houthis and get a foothold, in Yemen. And, let's not forget, we've been talking about the humanitarian aspect of this. Yemen was already one of the poorest countries in the region. 10,000 people are dead. Millions are at the brink of starvation now. But it's troubling to know that the United States, is in this strange position of having supplied crucial information to the Saudi-led coalition, as well as refueling their warplanes, even though we have denied providing any additional support to the coalition's military operations. But, in a sense, we have a side here. The Saudis and the Emiratis are our friends, even though the attacks that they have done, have really put children and women and innocent civilians in the crosshairs, and it's incredibly troubling. But you're absolutely right that it's another regional proxy war fighting out the Sunni-Shia conflict. And, unfortunately, we're not seeing the international community resolving that situation, even though it's been dragging on for more than 3 years.
We welcome any more questions you have about the Yemeni conflict while we still have Scott Paul with us for the remainder of the roundup. Before we keep moving, I should make a quick correction regarding what we said about the World Cup. Cindy writes, FYI, the U.S. has hosted two World Cups since the last men's World Cup. The Women's World Cup was in the USA in 1999 and 2003. They count too. Well said, Cindy. Point taken. Thank you. 72 lives were lost last year when a fire broke out in a London apartment building called Grenfell Tower. It shed light on economic inequality and the government's flagrant neglect of London's poor and ethnic minority communities in the population of Grenfell. 1 year later, the victims were remembered around the world with green light displays, including here in Salt Lake City, moments of silence and songs.
You just call only brother when you need a hand.
We all need
That concert was part of an emotional tribute at the base of Grenfell Tower on Thursday. Thousands of Londoners, including the pop star Adele, fought back tears as they honored those who perished in the fire. David Rennie, I'd love your sense of how the UK has responded to this. Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May acknowledged the first anniversary by apologizing for the initial response from the government and for failing to show compassion for the families of the victims.
I didn't, of course, on that first visit, meet members of the community or survivors. And I'm sorry for not having met them then. I regret that because I think people perhaps felt that they wanted those of us in power to know that we had understood and recognised what had happened, and perhaps felt that not meeting them immediately meant that I didn't care, and that was never the case.
It was Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May speaking this week. David, how far do you think the British government's response has gone toward easing the concerns over its response to Grenfell? Has the government made any kinds of promises toward concrete steps?
I think the problem is that part of this was a real discussion about things like fire safety, and part of it was the extraordinary symbolism of how the fire started, why it was so bad, and where it was. So I think if American listeners are wondering why is, admittedly a very terrible fire, such a big political story and so divisive, they need to know that this was a bad public housing complex in bad shape on the very edge of one of the very richest parts of central London. In a borough of central London that is controlled by the Conservative Party and is full of some of the richest houses in the world, multi-million pound houses. And so there was a sense that this had happened right on the doorstep of London's richest. But because the Conservatives had not done things like made sure that fire safety worked, they'd put some cladding on the building that was cheap, and that was one of the reasons it was such a terrible fire. So it was seen as, it was something much more than a fire. It was a sort of symbol of that you can be very poor and live right under the noses of the very rich in the middle of London and sort of be forgotten until this tragedy takes place. So I think that really, that symbolism is why this remains such a kind of divisive live issue.
One last story we'd like to get to before our time is up. Princeton published a series of Einstein's travel diaries detailing some of his journeys throughout Spain, the Middle East, and Asia. Some of them are rather disturbing. In the diaries, he referred to the Chinese as industrious, filthy, obtuse people. One entry details his arrival at Port Said in Egypt, saying he was confronted by Levantines of every shade as if spewed from hell. Kind of a surprising turn considering his Jewish ancestry, his background as a humanitarian, and as an advocate against racism in the U.S. When he moved to the U.S. in 1933, upon seeing segregated movie theaters, he joined the NAACP. Many thanks to our panel this week, Indira Lakshmanan of the Boston Globe and the Poynter Institute, Matthew LaPlante, a writer who also teaches at Utah State University, and David Rennie, Beijing Bureau Chief for The Economist. Thanks also to KUER Public Radio here in Salt Lake City. You can check out more of their excellent reporting and their wonderful weekday program, Radio West, online at KUER.org. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. We're back in the nation's capital Monday. Enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.